Good evening, everybody. My name is Ray Vowell, and I'm an alcoholic. I think that's a little loud. It's ringing. Or I am one of them. I'm supposed to qualify myself. I've not had a drink of alcohol or a mood-altering chemical since July the 20th of 1971. And that still means something to me today. I was out in Oregon recently, and I asked some guy, inadvertently, I've committed a grave sin in Oregon. I asked the guy, how long you been sober? And he said, who cares? And I said, well, I damn sure don't. You matter to me. It is neat to be here. A lot of people that I'd like to thank. I'd like to thank all of you for collectively giving me 2.5-3 hours of your time. Hell, I came all the way from Texas. I mean, y'all can't do that much. I mean, just remember that I'm the lull before the dance. That's all. I mean, you get to. But I do want to thank Ed, and I want to thank the committee. And I got to tell you one thing. Ed, I got the darndest shock when we got into the airport. Ed's carrying my golf clubs, and I'm carrying my suitcase. And we come out to his truck, and I thought, my God, this guy got the ugliest wife I've ever seen in my life. It's his dog. And I was glad when he said, do you mind riding with my dog? I thought, my God, I'd hate to ride all the way up to Hammond with a woman ugly as that. I did. In the daylight, you know. And then I thought, you know, you probably have it sometime or another. And then the dog rejected me and went over and sat by Ed. But I do, seen some old friends. That's one of the neat things about getting to do this sort of thing is you get to meet old friends. And the Fundabergs and I go back to, you know, when. And we none of us can figure out, you know, when it really was. The Pistols and I saw each other last in Minnesota. I have no idea where we first met. And then met a new friend, Craig, and got to play golf today. And We had a pretty even golf match. These three guys were really good. I played with a guy named Keith and a guy named Dennis and Craig. And if you heard Craig's story last night, you know, I'm sitting over there thinking, I don't play golf with this guy. Hell, he lives on a golf course, you know. I mean, this guy designs golf courses for a living, yeah. But it was really neat because they let me play off the women's tees. And I'm not kidding you. They really did, and it kind of evened things out, and we all played together that way. And the only reason I shared that with you tonight is that is my sobriety has progressed to the point where I can stand and say that. You know, that I mean, you know, I would have been mad as hell if they had told you. But you know, I've come to the point in my life where I don't have to impress you. You know that. You know, nobody even laughed at me. Well, they did laugh when I went in the women's restroom. But hitting off the ladies' tees one bit. I want to thank Ed, the committee. If I've left anybody, oh, Karen, it's always good to see her again. Yeah, and if I missed anybody, why, come over to my room tonight. And you know, and whoever it was who called my room last night every hour last night and didn't say anything, I want you to know that I love you. And I hope you live to be 100 years old and have the toothache every day. I told Karen two jokes, and she couldn't tell them. She screwed them up every time she tried to tell them. So I'll tell you what they are. You should have heard these yesterday. Old man walking down the road, and he sees a frog. And the frog says, I've been bewitched. Kiss me, and I'll turn into a beautiful girl. The old man looks around. He looks at the frog. He picks it up. He puts the frog in his pocket. And the frog's hollering, you know, hey, let me out, you dumb butt. Didn't you understand what I said? You know, kiss me on the lips and I'll turn into a beautiful woman. And the old man said, at my age, I'd rather have a talking frog. And the other one she was supposed to tell you last night was, the waiter comes up to this lady in a restaurant and says, "Madam, your husband just slid under the table." And she said, "You're mistaken. My husband just came in the door." Now I see what kind of crowd I'm dealing with. Okay. So I'm Ray Vowell. I'm an alcoholic. Somebody asked me once up in Omaha, Nebraska. Guy came up to me. I went up to visit Peggy and the guy she lives with up there, Dick. And guy comes up to me and he says, "Are you an Anda?" And I said, "I don't know. What's an Anda?" He said, "Are you one of those people that gets up at AA meetings and says, 'I'm an alcoholic and an addict'?" That's not me. He said, "Good." I said, "I'm an alcoholic who did a hell of a lot of drugs." And I want you to know one thing. You can have all the damn arguments that you want to. I've been in this program almost 25 years, and I still get, I get hysterical when I listen to that preamble. "We do not wish to engage in any controversy." That's gotta be the most hilarious thing I ever heard in my life. I asked my sponsor about that one time, and he said, "Oh, I can explain that. We don't wish to, we just do." So, you know, I don't get into these arguments. You know, I'm not a pure anything. I want you to know this, that I'm not pure anything. Anything make me feel single and see double, I'd do it. You know, I ain't kidding. Somebody asked me one time, said, "What's your drug of choice?" I said, "What you got?" So, you know, I'm here tonight. I have become a bleeding deacon. You know, I have progressed in my recovery to the point where I very seldom give advice. I go to meetings to be there because I at one point come to the realization that 25 years ago, if everybody who had gotten sober had stopped coming, I would have been in a hell of a mess. And so I still feel a responsibility to go to meetings. And I don't go there, to help them. I did that in my first year. You know, now I go to help me, yeah. And I'll go ahead and finish qualifying myself. I'm also a preacher. I'm a minister. I'm a Baptist minister. I'm a Southern Baptist minister. And I don't apologize for that. I'm no more ashamed of being a preacher than I am being an alcoholic. They're both incurable. You have to learn to live with it now. I would say this, that if I had it to do over again and I was starting my career anew, I would get me a white piano and a white suit, and I would go on television and I would tell you to send your money to God, and I would give you my address. Because I just love that concept. My faith has been somewhat shaken in the past few years at TV evangelists. Sometimes I think they're not truthful. They stand up on television and they say, "God told me to tell you." You know, anybody that pronounces God with a W, you beware. I had a lady come up to me the other day in church, and she said, "God told me this morning to tell you something." And I said, "That's funny. I talked to God this morning. He didn't mention you at all." So sometime I wonder if God really does talk to these people, you know. I mean, wouldn't it make sense to you that if God talked directly to these people, he would have said, "Jimmy, don't pick up the whore. The police is right behind you." It just kind of looks that way to me, you know. So not only am I an alcoholic and a Southern Baptist preacher, I also am a psychotherapist. licensed and inflicted by the state of Texas upon an unsuspecting public. And in my role as a psychotherapist, I sit in an office every week listening to people that are a whole hell of a lot sicker than we are, and they don't have a clue what. You know, I believe as I stand here tonight, and I can only speak for myself, I recommend to you wholeheartedly, if you hear something tonight that you cannot reconcile with what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you disregard it. That's what the book says we're supposed to do. Second instruction I'll give you tonight is if you get through before I do, go on. You know, I mean, your butt's not glued to the chair, and I promise you one thing here in the beginning, that I will stop talking when I get through. Now, I have not always done that. There have been many times in my life when I talked after I got through, but I try not to do that anymore. But I believe as I stand here tonight that we people who sit in rooms like this across the world are the most fortunate people upon the face of the earth, because we know what our problem is and we know the solution. We know, you know, I believe that the God of my understanding loves us more than he does everybody else. Because I'm an alcoholic, you know, and I think that I'm special. Yeah. You don't believe that. I can tell some of you are snickering. Somebody turned white in the back and said, how can he say that? It's very simple. God knows alcoholics. I mean, God, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be here, you know. God understands alcoholics. Alcoholics suffer from a condition called moreism. You know? I mean, you can ism everything, but, you know, my basic problem is that I wanted more of everything than anybody else in the world. I never wanted one of anything in my whole life. And God knew that. And he knows that about you. So he gave the whole world 10 commandments. But he gave us 12 steps. Because he knew if we didn't have more than they did, we wouldn't play. So I sit here, you know, and I sit in this office and I listen to these sick people, you know. I mean, sometimes I want to just say to them, why don't y'all go get drunk? You know, stay drunk for 10 or 12 years, come back and I'll introduce you to some folks that can help you, you know. I don't say that because Blue Cross doesn't cover it, but, you know, to me it is amazing that any of us ever made it into this room. You know, I mean, in the society that we have lived in, and I'm not blaming anybody on my, you know, I'm not blaming my problems on anybody else. Mine were self-created. You know, I have a disease. But I want you to know I indulged that disease to the best of my ability for as long as I could till I reached the point where I was so damn sick that my disease betrayed me. You know, we have a tendency in AA to tell the newcomers, you know, you're not having any fun. You know, I had a lady come to my office the other day whose 15-year-old son has discovered sex. And she wants me to call him into my office and tell him he's not enjoying that. And I ain't going to do it. No. But, you know, it's the world out there is so confusing to me anymore. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but the things that go on around me today, and the older I get, the more confusing they are. I was sitting in the mall the other day waiting on my wife, and about, man, I always try to give everybody something that they can take away and use, okay? Because it's kind of a waste of time if we don't get something out of this, you know. So first of all, man, I'm going to tell you one thing. If you go shopping with your wife in the mall, if you want to speed her up, wait for her in front of Victoria's Secret. And by the way, she ain't got no secrets. And the other thing is for you ladies, so you'll have something to carry home with that you can use, never fry bacon in the nude. So now, if nothing else I say tonight amounts to anything, you've got something to take home with you. Okay. So I'm sitting in this mall waiting on my wife, and this young couple come down through the mall, and he's got a punk rock haircut. I mean, I'm not knocking it. It just, you know, I mean, it's spiked out to about here, and it's blue on one side, and it's orange on the other. And they stop right in front of where I'm sitting, and he picks up a pair of sunglasses off of the little kiosk stand there. And he takes these sunglasses and he puts them on, and he turns around and he said, "How did these do?" And she says, "Take those off, they make you look stupid." I mean, you know, it kind of makes you wonder, you know. I mean, I said, "God, let me go to an AA meeting real quick. I need some sanity here, you know." I was sitting in church the other morning, and a lady passed by right in front of where I was sitting. She had three little kids with her, and she, right in front of me, she stopped and she said, "Do y'all want a whipping?" That's got to be the dumbest question I've heard in my life. Can you imagine her reaction if those kids had looked up and said, "Yeah, Mama, beat the hell out of them?" It's kind of a confusing world, isn't it? Years ago, I was changing planes in Chicago one Sunday afternoon. I was sitting waiting for my plane. I didn't know I was sitting on a newspaper. Little guy comes up to me and he said, "Are you reading that paper?" I stood up, turned the page, sat back down and said, "Yes, I am." So it all gets kind of confusing, doesn't it? That lady came in my office the other day and she said, "Doctor, my son is making mud pies." And I said, "Well, I wouldn't worry about that. That's pretty normal." She said, "Yeah, but he bites them." And I said, "I wouldn't get all upset about that." I said, "That's pretty normal behavior." She said, "I don't agree with you." She said, "I don't think that's normal at all, and neither does his wife." So anyway, I decided several years ago that if I was going to find any sanity in the world, I was going to go back to church. Because we all know that those people over there, they're sane, right? I mean, they've got peace of mind and serenity, you know, and they know God and all this stuff, you know. So, you know that's not true. I'm an alcoholic. Hell, I ain't going to go back to church. I want to run one. And so I enrolled in Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary up in Fort Worth, Texas, and I graduated. You know, here I am, I got a Oral Roberts suit, Pat Robertson shoes, Billy Graham haircut, and a Jim Baker Bible, which is for sale. I'll throw in a t-shirt. And you know, there was nobody there waiting on me. Nobody wanted a 40-year-old, inexperienced, alcoholic, Baptist preacher. You know? But finally I did. I got a little church, and I'll tell you a little bit later exactly how that came about. But I got a little church down in Beeville, Texas, and of course when you become the under-shepherd of the flock, you have to visit your flock. And so the first place I went to visit was in the home of three old maids. Now, we don't say old maid in the Baptist church anymore. That's not politically correct. We say single by choice. In this particular case, I think if those ladies had ever had a choice, but anyway, it was... See, it's got me all confused. Yeah, I'm 62 years old, and this political correct stuff has just got me all screwed up. So we can't say hymnal in the Baptist church anymore. We tried saying hernal. And that didn't work. And you know, it just kind of loses something when you stand up on Sunday morning and say, "Would everybody take your personal in hand?" So I've been confused all my life. It never goes away. I mean, I remember when I was a teenage boy, you know, my dad said, "Get a hold of yourself." And I did, and it got punished. And so I'm visiting in the home of these three little old ladies who are single by choice. And they said to me, would you like some coffee and cake? And I said, well, sure, yeah. So they all three get up and go to the kitchen, and I'm sitting there thumbing through a magazine, and I looked over, and there was a bowl of peanuts on the table. I reached over, got a handful of peanuts, and I'm thumbing through the magazine, and I reached over and got another handful of peanuts. And before they got back, I ate the whole bowl of peanuts. And so they come back, you know, and one of these little old ladies says, you know what, Ted, looks like you ate the whole bowl. I said, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to eat them all. She said, oh, we don't mind. Said, since we had our teeth pulled, we can't do nothing but suck the chocolate off of them anyway. So I'm sitting here. I'm sitting in the room with these three little old ladies who are single by choice, and I'm eating coffee. I'm eating cake and drinking coffee, and I look up on the piano, and there's a glass of water with a condom floating in. And I'm trying not to look at it. Have you ever noticed when there's something you don't want to look at, no matter where you turn, it's there? And I couldn't stand it, so finally I turned around to one of these ladies and I said, what is that? And she said, we don't know. She said, we found it in the park. And it said on the package, place on organ for prevention of disease. And she said, we didn't have an organ, so we put it on the piano. And she said, you know what, preacher, we haven't even had a cold all winter. And I tell that story because it reminds me a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even when you don't have a clue of what it is, it still works. Yeah. I love it. That's my second thing that I've come to love in Alcoholics Anonymous is how it works. Yeah? I didn't tell you how it works. This tells you what we did. I don't have a clue how this works, do you? I remember asking my sponsor. I said, how does this work? He said, we don't know. I said, well, who's in charge? He said, everybody. I said, who makes the decisions? He said, we all do. I said, well, who's the leaders? We don't have any. I said, that won't work. He said, I know. I said, why do we keep going to these damned old meetings? And he said, it's the only way I found to stay sober. And that's not basically true, because you know what it is? Let me tell you how, you know, in my opinion, how it works. It works when one person loves another person enough to share their experience, strength, and hope. And I'm here tonight not because of my wisdom and my education and my religion. I'm here tonight because 24 years and 10 months ago, two men showed up at my house. Now, that didn't happen immediately. I actually joined Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife and I have been married 41 years. Thank you. I've won one argument in 41 years. And that is that I'm smarter than she is. I am. She told me I could say that. Because every time she wants to argue, I just say, look at who you married. I wouldn't have married somebody like she did. And if I had, I damn sure wouldn't have stayed there for 41 years now. But on July the 19th, 1971, in a little tract home out in Irving, Texas, my wife came to me and she said, the children and I have had a meeting and we have audited you. And I said, how did I make out? And she said, we figured out it cost us about $500 a month more to keep you than you bring in. And we can't afford you anymore. And so I went down and joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back home, and we fell madly in love. And my children started making straight A's in school. The police used to stop by and ask my advice. All the crabgrass died in my lawn. Ed McMahon came. And we have been deliriously happy ever since. Now, if you believe that, let's all stand, join hands, and say the Lord's Prayer, because you're too dumb to hear the rest of what I got to say. The fact of the matter is, brothers and sisters, I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous on July the 19th, 1971, because I had no place else to go. And I believe as I stand here tonight that if I could have found one more person that would have believed one more lie, if I could have bummed one more dime, if I could have run one more scam, I'd still be drunk. I reached the point where I had absolutely nowhere to go. Nobody cared. My wife had said to me, you cannot live here anymore. And so I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I called down there and I got a person on the phone. I hated that. I don't like people much, you know. I didn't at all in those days. If people lie to you. You know, people will tell your wife where you've been when you disappear for a week. You know, people will fire you because you don't show up at work. You know that? People will send your checks back from the bank just because you don't make deposits. I still got this thing about bankers. Bankers are all liars. You know that? I mean, bankers are crazy. They're nuts. Now, I know there's some bankers in this audience tonight, but they're nuts. Why else would they charge you $25 of what they already know you ain't got when you write a bad check? Does that make sense to you? You know what I mean? Anyway, I get this person on the phone, and I said, I'd like to talk to somebody about drinking, which was true. And he said, well, we're having a meeting now. Can you come? And I said, can you come if you've been drinking? He said, yeah, most people have. So I hung up and I went in and I poured me out a big glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey because I was in my ethnic period at this time. Fine old cultural wine. And my wife said, what are you going to do? And I said, the man said, have a drink and come on down there. See, you've got to understand about alcoholism. Alcoholics have the ability to hear anything they want to hear regardless of what's been said. So I have this big glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey, and I go to my first AA meeting, and when I got there, it was gone. Now, it didn't surprise me. Wasn't it all unusual in those days for me to call somebody and tell them I was coming, and when I get there, they'd be gone? Happened a lot. Unfortunately, I went to the wrong building. I went to a real estate sales meeting. They looked like alcoholics. I asked them if they were alcoholics. I broke up a sales meeting. And so I figured by this time I've made enough effort for one day, and so I go back home. And when I got home, everything I owned was on the front porch. And that wasn't any big deal either. It all fit in one pillowcase. And I knocked on the door, and my wife came to the door, and I said, can I use your telephone? And she said, for what? I said, I couldn't find Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to call them back. Because, see, I know by now they'll be gone. I can get that dumb machine that says there's no one here at this time. But if you have a problem, you know, and, well, hell, if I had a problem, I want to talk to a machine, you know. And so I call back then. I still get a people on the phone. And I said, I'd like to talk to somebody about drinking. And he said, well, we could come over. And I said, oh, no, not tonight. I said, you know, 2 or 3 days be okay. And he said, no, if you have a need, we can come right now. I said, in fact, there's two of us sitting here. We're not doing anything. And we can come over there. And I said, okay. And I told my wife to get the kids and get in the back of the house because something big was about to happen in our home. Because I knew what they were going to do. They were going to come over there, and they were going to tell me I couldn't drink, and I was going to whoop their ass. Because people were always doing that to me. Did people ever do you that way? And people always tell me, son, you can't drink, you know. I mean, my daddy told me that before I was 16 years old. He said, son, you can't drink. You've got to stop this. The sheriff who ran me out of the county where I was born said, your basic problem is you can't drink. the deputy who took me to the Alabama state line and said, walk across and don't come back, said, your basic problem is something you cannot drink, you know. I've had strangers walk up to me. I'd be laying flat on my back, puking straight up. And they would say, you can't drink. And I think, Jesus, well, I mean, what do they think this is? You know, I can drink. You know, I can't drink without going to jail, and I can't drink without, you know, doing all the stuff that goes with drinking, but I could drink. You know, so just, you know, we say things to alcoholics that don't make a lot of sense. And so I know these guys are going to come, they're going to say, you can't drink. And so I went in, got me another glass of Mad Dog Lucy Deucey, so when they come, I'd be in shape to fight. And two of the weirdest dudes you ever saw showed up at my door. I mean, one guy was a garbage man. He drove a garbage truck, you know. And the other guy was an executive with Lone Star Gas Company. And they came in my house and they said stupid stuff. You know, first thing they said is, you just got to take it easy. I mean, you know, I mean, you couldn't take it much easier than I was taking it. Yeah. One of them said, let go and let God. I never did. I said, I don't have a hold of anything. And if I did, God wouldn't put his hands on it. I guarantee you that. And then one of them asked me, said, do you think you could go one day without a drink? And I said, well, of course. And then he got real snotty, you know. And he said, well, when did you? And you know what? Here I am almost 25 years later, and I still can't tell you how long it had been since I'd gone a 24-hour period without a drink. And he said, would you be willing to give it a try? And I said, well, I will tomorrow. It's already too late today. And they were so kind. And they said, no, let's just try it the rest of today. And they gave me the name. They wanted me to go with them, and of course I wouldn't do that. They gave me a name of a lady who worked in my office building, and that offended me because they didn't hire drunks where I worked. And they left. And for some reason, I got up the next morning, and I had to go to work. And I went to work. And when, of course, you know what happened. I went to work without a drink, and my world fell apart. I got deathly sick. And I'm running up and down the halls, you know, and I'm going nuts. And I remembered this lady's name, and so I'm trying to figure out, now, how am I going to find this woman? You know, do you run up and down the hall screaming out her name, or do you go knock on doors, you know, and say, hey, are, you know, are you married, the drunk, or are you the married that was anonymous till I told everybody to, you know? But I remember there was a lady named Mary who ran the switchboard out in the lobby, and I went and I couldn't say anything to her, and I was shaking and I was sick, and I handed her this man's card, and she turned around to the guy that worked with her, and she said, take over, I don't know when I'll be back. And I think I had my first miracle that morning, because we went into the cafeteria at 9 o'clock in a government office building, and there was nobody there. That's a miracle. And she set me down there, and she got on the telephone, and she made a phone call, and she said, I'm sending a guy to you. And she came back, and she said, yeah, I'm going to send you to the Irving group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I won't make it. And she said, why not? And I said, because right down at the corner, there's a liquor store, and that's as far as I'll go. And she said, don't go that way. I said, how you get to Irving? She said, go this way. Yeah. Go this way. There's no liquor store. Just dry all the way to Irving that way. Well, obviously, I'd never been that way. And you know what? I was mad at her. I was really furious with her because I thought if she really wanted to help me, she would have taken me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know today that what she wanted to find out was, did I really want to go? And, you know, I think today that Mary, bless her heart, was kind of like a mother, you know, taking a little kid and slapping it on its butt and letting it run across the wall, run across the room to somebody who catches it, letting it take its own step. And I went out there, and I got to the Irving group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went up and I knocked on the door, and the ugliest guy I ever saw in my life opened the door, and he said, son, you're in the right place. And I said, what do you do here? And it's all I can do to stand up. I had sores all over my body. I had wide sores in my mouth. And I thought, he won't let me in there. But he did. He said, would you like a cup of coffee? And I just stepped right inside the door and leaned back against the wall because I was afraid to go any further. And I said, yes, sir, I would. And he comes back and he hands me a cup of coffee. And I took one swallow of coffee and puked on the floor. And I knew my AA was over. Because when you puke on the floor, they make you leave. It has been my experience that that still holds true. You know, my wife gets terribly upset, you know, when I use the word puke, because I have 4 college degrees, and I don't say that in a bragging way. It's just that, you know, she says, you know, you're well educated. You shouldn't use words like puke. I don't know how to describe what I did any other way. I have never burped, upchucked, thrown up, barked, or hurled in my life. I puke. Puking's like riding a bicycle. Once you learn, you never forget how to. You know, I had the flu last week. Craig and I both had this virus thing. I don't know if it's flu or what. And I can still puke standing straight up and not get any on my shoes. I may get some on your shoes, but that's... But you know, a strange thing happened. This little old man took me by the arm and he carried me over in the corner and he set me down and he comes back with a bucket and a glass. And I said, what is that? And he said, it's honey, orange juice, and raw egg. And then I knew what the bucket was for. And I sat there and I drank that honey, orange juice, and raw egg and I puked in that bucket. And then another strange thing happened. I looked up and Mary came through the door. She had followed me. And then another strange thing happened. I had more honey, orange juice, and raw egg, and I puked in the bucket again. That wasn't strange. The strange thing was that those 2 weird dudes that had been at my house the night before showed up. And we had a good time. They sat around a circle and watched me drink honey, orange juice, and raw egg and puke in a bucket. While they told funny stories about people who drink honey, orange juice, and raw egg and puke in a bucket. But I looked back and I looked back and I remember that all that day, one of those people had an arm around my shoulders. And I want you to know something. I wasn't a pleasant person to sit next to in those days. What you see standing here in no way represents what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had long since given up bathing. I took a bath one night and my wife hid my clothes. And the liquor store closed before I got there and I quit bathing. I mean, you laugh if you want to, but I did. I quit bathing. I'm very clever. So I didn't take my clothes off. Eventually, they would come off, and I would replace them. And those people loved me that day. I didn't realize that. I didn't know what was happening, but they sat there. And finally, I just asked one of them, I said, can I just pour this in the bucket? And they explained to me that even though I was puking in the bucket, that every time I drank that, I was retaining some protein and some sugar, and it was keeping me from going into DTs, and that got my attention because I knew about DTs. My wife's a registered nurse, and I think she saved my life many times in my drinking days because I suffered from delirium. I was a blackout drinker. I really, you know, I can't tell you a lot of funny stories about my drinking because I really don't know. But you know what? I knew about DTs. I had a country and western band that played in my bathroom. And I was the lead singer. One of my greatest disappointments in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I sobered up and found out I could not play the guitar. And I used to cook for my band. and I only knew how to cook grits. And I only knew how to cook them a box at a time. And if you cook a whole box of grits, it takes a big salad bowl to hold them. And if you got a big salad bowl full of grits, it takes a whole pound of margarine. And if you got a big salad bowl full of hot grits with a pound of margarine, you cannot eat them with clothes on. And I weighed 404 pounds. I'm serious. And I would sit naked up in the bed with a big bowl of grits, and my band would stand around the bed, and we would pick and sing and eat grits. I'm sure my wife loved that picture. I thank God I never saw it. But she would come home from work at 11 o'clock, about 11:30, and the band was terrified of her. And she would come in and she'd say, "It's time for the band to go home," and they would leave. And that's what I knew about DTs. The only other thing I can tell you about DTs is plain tap water will not flush green men out of your air conditioning duct. It just won't. They just swim through it. And so they said, if you drink this, it'll keep you from going into DTs. And so they got my attention. And that's how I got the Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have anywhere else to go. There were 3 warrants out for my arrest. I was on probation at my government job, and my wife would not let me come home. And so I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent day after day and hour after hour sitting in dumb old discussion meetings waiting for my turn to speak. And I would sit there during that hour waiting for my turn to speak. And then when my turn came, I would share my wisdom with the group. And I would sit there the rest of the hour thinking about what I had said. What are you laughing about? You've all done the same damn thing. Everyone. And one day I had a spiritual awakening. I looked up on the wall and it said, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable." And I said, "Wow. What a thought. This is so simple." They kept saying it was a simple program. Next morning I got in my old whiskey beat up bent car and I went down to see Sheriff Bill Decker. He's the sheriff of Dallas County. And I said, "Sheriff Decker, I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable." He said, "I'm glad to hear that, Ray, but you're still going to the joint if you don't cover those checks." I don't know what y'all call that in Louisiana, but in Texas, going to the joint means that you're going to take the accelerated course in agriculture up at Huntsville. Which literally means you're going to pick some cotton and ain't going to get no pay. I left his office and I went out to see my boss, and I got a hell of a surprise there, because when I got in his office, somebody was sitting at my desk. And I went in to see him, and I said, "Dr. Alexander, I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life has become unmanageable." And he said, "I'm glad to hear that, but Friday is still your last day. Your suspension is up Friday, and we've decided not to let you stay." So I went out to see my wife, and I said, "Honey, I have joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life has become unmanageable." She said, "You still can't live here." And I went back down to the group, and I said, "This crap don't work." About 3 days later, I got a call from Henry Wade, who was the district attorney of Dallas County. And he said, "Ray, Sheriff Decker has called me." We were on a first name basis. He said, "Ray, Sheriff Decker has called me, and we have decided that we're going to file your case for 90 days and see what happens." Dr. Alexander called me, and he said, "We have decided to continue your suspension for 6 more months and see what happens." And Faith said, "You still can't come home." And I thought, well, 2 out of 3 is a better deal than I got anywhere else. And so I began my AA career going to them dumb old meetings, waiting for my turn to speak. And one Saturday night in a beginner's meeting, I don't know if you have beginner's meetings in Louisiana, but in Texas we have beginner's meetings, and we have them at 6 o'clock, and that's so they can clean the crap out and have a real meeting at 8 o'clock. And they always have one old-timer. We had this guy, his name was Curly G, and he was older than dirt. I mean, this guy farted dust. I mean, he was old. And he would look at you, and he'd grin, and he'd say, "It'll pass." That's what my grandmother used to say when she fed us prunes, you know. And I love beginner's meeting, and you ought to go to, you ought to come to Texas and just attend the beginner's meeting. Beginner's meeting goes like this. First speaker will say, "I used to drink shoe polish." And the next speaker will say, "That's nothing. I used to drink kerosene lit." The next speaker will say, "I got drunk in Nashville and woke up in Memphis." The next speaker said, "That's nothing. I got drunk in Hong Kong and woke up in Montreal, Canada, in my car." And the next speaker will say, "I've been married 6 times. The next guy said, "That ain't nothing. I've been married 3 times since lunch. Once to my sister." And I'm sitting in the beginner's meeting waiting for my turn. And this irascible old fart named Curly looks at me. He had this terrible habit of asking the group questions and looking straight at me. And I'd answer. Because I knew the answer. He stopped the meeting. He looked right at me. And he said, "I'd like to ask you people a question." And I'm all ears, because I know the answer. I don't even know the question, but I know the answer. He said, "Have you ever been so drunk you didn't remember what you did?" I said, "Sure." He looked right at me again. He said, "I'd like to ask you people another question. Have you ever woke up in the bed with a 95-year-old woman with sores all over her body?" And I said, "Hell no." And he said, "How do you know?" Now, the other book that I work out of is called the Bible, and I know it's not approved AA literature, but I read it anyway. And in there it says, God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. And that remark by that old man put me square into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all my education, and all my years of bumming around, and all my analytical powers never ever convinced me like that old man, because I realized for the first time I didn't know what I had done. And I walked out of that meeting and I went to my sponsor's house. I have to tell you about my sponsor. He came up to me one night and said, "My name's Al and I'm your sponsor." I said, "I thought you got to choose a sponsor." He said, "You do, you did, and I'm him." And I said, "I'm not sure I'm ready for sponsorship." He said, "Neither am I, but nonetheless, I'm your sponsor." And I said, but, and he said, "You don't understand, do you?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "We drew straws and I lost." Not only was I unhygienic, I was very verbal and I was very disruptive. And in August of 1971, the steering committee of the Irving Group of Alcoholics Anonymous had a meeting.
And the meeting was to determine whether or not they would let me continue to come. And it was decided that if they made me leave, I would probably die. But if I were going to be allowed to continue, somebody would have to be responsible for me. And they really did draw straws, and Al really lost. And God, as I understand him, put the most wonderful person I ever met in my life that day. And I fought it for a year. But I went to Al's house, so I knocked on the door, and he came to the door, and the big tears was running down my face, and he said, "What in the world's wrong with you now?" And I said, "I've just found out a terrible thing." And he said, "What's that?" I said, "I don't know what I've done." He said, "None of us do." I said, "I don't give a damn about the rest of you. I'm talking about me. I don't know what I've done." And he said, "Well, what does that mean?" And I said, "I suspect it means I can never look down my nose again at another human being because I don't know what I've done." You see, with the realization that I don't know what I've done comes the realization that I have absolutely no right to judge because I don't know what I've done. And Al looked me in the eye, got me by the arm, and he didn't say, "We'll read a book, come back Tuesday." He said, "Come in and sit down." And we began a program that has worked for 24 and a half years of my life. Al taught me that there were two meanings to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were three, actually. There was AA, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was absolute abstinence. But Al taught me that the most important meaning of the initials AA are these: admitted and accepted that we really are powerless over alcohol. Al taught me that every alcoholic has two tools that he uses, and those are called rationalization and justification. And as long as I can rationalize away what I've done and justify what I'm about to do, I'll probably continue to do it. Al taught me by example. Al taught me that I was going to have to come to some realization that I was not the most powerful thing in the world. I balked. Oh, I balked. One Sunday morning we were sitting in a meeting in Arlington, Texas. The phone rang. The guy motioned for us to listen. The lady on the other end said, "I'm drunk." "That's why I'm sorry to hear that. Who are you?" She said, "Oh, you know me. I've been coming to meetings down there for about 9 months." He said, "Well, why are you drunk?" And she said, "It's the peanut butter." He said, "I don't understand. You got drunk on peanut butter?" She said, "Hell no, we ain't got no peanut butter." And my husband came home and raised cane because we didn't have any peanut butter, and I went down to 7-Eleven and I bought 2 6-packs and I drank all 12 of them. And he said, "Lady, wouldn't it have been simpler to have just got a jar of peanut butter?" She said, "To hell with him. I don't care if he never gets any more peanut butter." And we laugh about that, but how many people have you ever seen who are alcoholic start a fight so they can storm out of the house and go get drunk? How many guys or women have you ever seen who said, "Honey, life is too good. I think I'll go screw my head up for a week. You know, I'm probably going to get in a fight or two while I'm gone, going to steal a little money along, you know, and I'd probably sleep with a few people I ordinarily wouldn't associate with. Probably be in jail a time or two, and I'd probably be in the hospital some, you know. I'm probably going to get naked on the street and embarrass our whole family, but don't worry, babe, I'll be back in a week." You never heard that. Rationalization and justification. And as long as you can do that, you can keep practicing. And then, you know, we came to step two, and I don't get nervous. I'm not going through all 12 of them. You're supposed to do that with your sponsor. But I just want to share with you what Al showed me. He said, you know, that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I love that. I don't know about you. I hear people say, "I don't want to be insane." You know, hell, I was thrilled to be insane. I want you to know that alcoholic and insanity was an upgrade for me. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was thoroughly convinced to the very core of my being that I was sorry as hell. because I had been told by everybody whose authority I respected in the least, you are sorry as hell. And I want you to know something, that on July the 20th of 1971, I brought the sorriest damn thing that I could create to you. And you took it, and you took the love that you spoke of in the big book, and you mixed it together, and you gave me back me. And yes, I came to believe, and I didn't have any flash of lightning. You know, I knew all about insanity. Gee, I've been to psychiatrists. We all have, I guess. You know, I remember they took me to the psychiatrist in Fort Worth. You know what I mean? He looked at me and said, son. I said, yes, sir. He said, I'm going to give you some pills. I said, you are. I want you to know one thing. I love pills. I mean, I really, you know, I believe, boy, back in those days, I'd rather have pills than a new sports car. I mean, I love big pills, little pills, red pills, green pills, short pills, long pills, round pills, square pills, triangular pills, pills with little cracks. I mean, boy, if I came to your house, first place I went was your bathroom. I didn't have any kidney problems. I wanted to look in your medicine cabinet. You know. I've taken enough Midol, I wouldn't have a cramp if I lived to be 150 years old. I'll never forget the day I found the little plastic thing with the dates on it. And I took the 26th, 27th, and 28th. I have a real good friend who's an oblate father down in Mission, Texas, and he looked at me one day and said, ever occur to you, you may be responsible for getting some woman pregnant you never even met? I mean, I love pills, you know, and the psychiatrist says to me, you know, he said, I'm going to give you some pills. I said, what do they do, doc? He said, they make you deathly sick if you drink. I said, hell, I already get deathly sick when I drink. He said, you know you're going to get deathly sick and you drink anyway. I said, uh-huh. He said, I don't understand that. I said, me either. Charged the $60 and he gave me a prescription. And you know what? The old boy, pretty smart. I got deathly sick. I wound up in intensive care at Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth. And I want you to know one thing. I guess I'd have been there longer, but I drank the alcohol out of the thermometer glass and they kicked me out. But I never took any more than pills. I wasn't stupid. So, you know, I came to believe, and the way I came to believe was so simple. I attended meetings, and Al would take me to meetings. God, he took me to meetings, you know, meeting, with three or four times a day on weekends, you know. And I never will forget, we had this guy showed up at our group. And the guy got up, you know, and he said, I don't want to go into no long drunk a log, but I had my first drink in 1935. And then here he goes, you know, and I left. I mean, it's about 9:40, I went home. Al followed me home. He said, where'd you go? I said, I got bored. He said, let me tell you something. The least you can get out of an AA meeting is courtesy. You know, you can have the patience and the tolerance. That old man may need to say that. I said, well, I'm sorry. He said, I know. Next night he came and got me, you know, and he said, we're going to Win Oaks group tonight. And I said, oh, great, you know, don't go to a visit, you know. So we go over to Win Oaks and get a cup of coffee, and we sit down, and they're reading the preamble, and I look over, and oh, God, the old man's sitting there, you know, same guy. He gets up, and he says, I won't go in no drunk a lot, but I took my first drink in 1935, you know. And the next night he comes up and says, we're going to Preston Road group tonight. I said, well, thank God we won't be over there in Oak Cliff. We get up there and we're late, you know, and I'm going up the steps to the Preston Road. I hear on the PA system, I took my first drink in 1935. So Friday night he said, well, we're going to do something different tonight. I said, what? He said, we're going to an Al-Anon anniversary. And I said, well, thank God. I don't have to hear that son of a gun, you know. So we go over there and then get some cake and a cup of coffee, and I sit down, and this sweet little old lady, you know, with the blue hair gets up, and she says, I don't want to take my husband's inventory, but he had his first drink in 1935. I mean, we did that for a week and a half, and finally, you know, this old guy was a guru. He went all around Dallas, you know, and finally one night we were coming home, and I said, Al, you know what, that old bastard's beginning to make sense. Canal said, thank God I don't think I could have stood to listen to him one more night. You know? But he taught me that, you know. He taught me that, you know. And then we got to step three, and I said, you know what, Al, I got a problem with this God thing. And he said, you know, the only thing you need to know about God is there is one and you ain't him. And I wasn't sure I wanted to give up the job. But then Al said something that I've never forgotten to this day. He said, you may be God if you choose. But if you do, you must live with what you create. Wow. I said, wait a minute. You can play God if you want to, but you must live with what you create. I said, Al, God, you know, this God thing, I grew up in South Georgia, you know, and I mean, I grew up in the Baptist church, and my concept of God was some old preacher standing up there telling me that I had to do what he said was right or God wouldn't love me. And I couldn't do it. I was doomed to failure, you know. I mean, I'd already done everything I was capable of, and I couldn't wait till I got old enough to do the rest, you know. And he's telling me, you know, God's going to get me. I remember my dad saying, well, I want to go to a dance once. He said, you can't go. I said, why not? He said, you'll see things there you got no business seeing. Well, hell, I had to go then, you know. And so I got there, and you know, I hadn't been there 5 minutes till my dad. I saw my dad was right. My dad was right. I did see something I shouldn't have seen. My dad was there. And I was all confused, you know. I want you to understand one thing, that you gave me this, and if I never got anything else, it'd be worth the ride. You know, you taught me the difference between religion and spirituality. You see, religion is man trying to impress other men with how good he is. And spirituality, as I learned in this program, is being humble enough to let God show me how good he is. I don't have to prove anything to you. I don't have to live up to your expectations. And I know you're getting ready for the dance, and some of his butts are beginning to twitch and all this stuff, so let's get on to the end. I would be remiss if I didn't share with you what it's been like since. We went through those steps. I mean, Al and I, we did those things, and I did inventories and all this, and you need to do that, and if you haven't done it, you need to get with your sponsor because you need some direction to do it. But let me share this with you. That I was sitting in the Irving group one Saturday afternoon, and they were setting up a bingo, and I didn't approve of that because that's gambling. And then after bingo, they took the tables down and folded them up, and they were going to have a dance, and I didn't approve of that because we don't dance, you know. And I've never figured out why. I don't know why we don't dance. I know how I don't dance. I don't know how, you know. But the main thing is that these kids were doing this, and they only been around 5 or 6 months, and they were laughing, and they were joking, and they were cutting up, and they weren't taking my program serious, and it really ticked me off. And I went down to see Al, and I walked into his office, and I said, I want to ask you one thing. You've never lied to me. When is something good going to happen to me? And he looked at me, and he said, it just might be that you're one of those people good things never happen to. And he said, Ray, where do you live? I said, I live over in Northwest Park. Where do you sleep? I said, in the bedroom with my wife. He said, huh. How are things at work, Ray? I said, well, you know, I've been promoted. I'm head of the department now. And he said, huh. How did you get down here today, Ray? And I said, in my new car. And he said, huh. I hope you hang around AA long enough, Ray, for something good to happen to you someday. And I walked out of his office, and I went to a little park in South Irving, and I sat under a pecan tree all afternoon crying because I realized how dumb and blind and stupid I really had been. And I thought back to the night they carried me to my first AA meeting, and my little boy went to the 7-Eleven, and he took the change out of his pocket, and he called his grandmother in Kentucky, and all he could say was, Mom, my daddy don't drink no more. I thought about the night that my wife insisted that I go to the recital with her, and I didn't want to go because I don't care much for that sort of thing, but she insisted. When we got there, it was my daughter. And I sat there and cried as my daughter sang in five languages because I didn't even know she could sing. I thought about the night that my son graduated from Irving High School, and he graduated in Irving Stadium where the Cowboys play, and there were about 2,000 people there in the stands, and all those people for 4 years had expected to be there to take care of and take part, and I was there because my son had personally invited me. And after the ceremony, he brought his friends up, and he said, "This is my dad, and we're proud of him." This was a little boy who used to be so afraid of his father that he would hide in the shrubbery at night till I passed out. Later he joined the Air Force, and he was a radio operator. He'd call me on the Mars network, and everybody could hear from Texas to Germany. He turned 40 last Saturday, and he has never since I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous called me that he did not say, "Daddy, I love you, and I'm proud of you." I could go on and on and on telling you things that have happened like that, but I'd like to share just a couple with you. Eleven years ago, I said to my wife, "I'd like to go back to school and get my doctorate." And she said, "Why don't you?" And I said, "I'd be 50 years old before I graduate." And she said, "Well, the way I figure, you're going to be 50 either way." And so I re-enrolled in the seminary, and I began a program of working on a PhD in counseling. And on January 2nd, 1984, I turned 50. And on May the 14th, 1984, I graduated summa cum laude with a Ph.D. in Christian psychology. On October the 15th, 1984, our daughter presented us with the most perfect, intelligent, gorgeous, little red-headed grandson that's ever lived, except for the one that was born 3 years later or the little girl that was born 5 years after that. And you know, if it weren't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed all those things. That little red-headed boy was 3.5 years old, and I was attending the School of Prophets in Dallas, First Baptist Church, and we had a suite of rooms in one of the hotels, and my daughter came to me and said, "How would you like to take Ryan and keep him all night?" The little boy had never spent the night away from his parents. And I said, "You'd let me do that?" And she said, "Yes, Daddy, I would." And I went to Walmart and bought $40 worth of little red trucks. And that little boy was in that hotel room, and he was down on the floor playing with those trucks. And he stopped, and he threw those trucks down, and he came, and he climbed up in my lap, and he put his arms around my neck, and he said, "Papa, I love you." And then he climbed down and he was playing, and a little while he came back, and every so often he would remember, and he'd throw the trucks down and he'd come climb up in my lap and he'd say, "Papa, I love you." And again I cried, not because the little boy said he loved me, but because I had been trusted by my daughter, who used to be so afraid of her father that she would lock herself in the bathroom and sleep in the bathtub with the most precious possession she had, her son. And I knew that night that not only am I recovering from alcoholism, not only have I been restored to the place where I want to be, but I had been forgiven by my family and by a loving God of my understanding. And I no longer had to be guilty, and I no longer had to punish myself. 5 years ago, I was on the way to speak at a conference in Oklahoma City, and I got a call on my car phone, and it was my son-in-law, and he said, "Just want to let you know, Kitty's in labor." And I said, "I'll come back." And he said, "No, that's what she said you would say. But she said to tell you that she was fine, and you go on and do what you need to do in Oklahoma City. Well, of course, at night I called home, and my wife was so excited, and she says, we have a granddaughter. And I was so excited. I got up at 5 o'clock the next morning, drove back to Dallas, and I went straight to the hospital. And I went in that room, and I sat on the side of the bed, and I hugged her, and she hugged me, and we cried. And then I said, why didn't you ever name one of those boys after me? And with tears in her eyes, she said, Daddy, that was the first, her name is Jacqueline Ray. She said, Daddy, the first time I got pregnant, that was the first name I picked out. But it just had to be for a little girl. Because I want you to know that any little girl is going to be really lucky to have you for a grandpa. He said, God's good. And I want you to know tonight that I make no apologies for my belief and my trust in God. Because it's through the God that you introduced me to that I can stand here and tell you this story. I'm no expert in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have experts here. Sober is as high as you get. But finally, I preached not too long ago in a little black church in Beeville, Texas. And I said, and finally, about four times, I kept saying, and finally, one of the old brothers up in the choir said, yeah, but not immediately. Well, finally and immediately, brothers and sisters, let me say this to you. If I could choose to be anywhere on the face of the earth tonight, I would choose to stand here with you. Because you see, I believe I'm the most blessed human being in the world because you see, you let me share with you, and that helps me. I know three things. Number one, I know which drink makes me drunk. That's the first one. Number two, I know who with God's help has the choice of whether or not I take that, and that's me. And number three, I know this. I see the love of God, and I see the expressions of Christianity in rooms like this more than I have ever seen in 21 years in the church. Thank you, and God bless you.